Welcome to the New York Times podcast. You're dropping 1500 on a hypnotherapist of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
The first time I tasted somebody else's spit, I had a coughing fit. I mistakenly called them by your name. I was let down, it wasn't the same. I'm doing fine, trying to derail my one-track mind, regaining my self-worth in record time. But I can't help but think of your other in the bed that was mine. Am I masochist, resisting urges to punch you in the teeth, call you a bitch and leave? Why did I come here to sit and watch you stare at your feet? What was the plan? Absolve your guilt and shake hands. I feel no need to forgive, but I might as well. But let me kiss your lips.
Oh, can you taste the anger? Can you taste the resentment? That is Lucy Dacus, Night Shift, the first song off of her new album, which is called Historian. It's a big week for releases, especially for young women in indie rock and punk adjacent spaces who have a lot to talk about.
Who have a lot of feelings, a lot of songs.
A lot going on. And
a lot of lines.
Yes, and bars, literally bars, but the best bars. Now that rap has basically post-bars, if we're just saying that, and I don't mean to be like old manish about it, but now that rap is post bars, I'll tell you where the bars are. The bars are here. I am joined today for this broad ranging conversation by Joe Coscarelli, pop music reporter in the New York Times.
Hey.
Karen Gans, pop music editor in the New York Times.
Hello.
John Perellis, chief pop music critic of the New York Times.
Right here.
We're going to talk about Lucy Dacus. We're also going to talk about Soccer Mommy. We're going to talk about Phoebe Bridgers, Julian Baker. I don't know, the Breeders.
I'm here to talk about the Breeders.
Karen, if you made your record in 2018, Karen Gans does not care. She's here to talk about the Breeders. She's not worried about you.
I'm on brand.
So let's start with Lucy Dacus. This is Lucy's second record, right, Joe?
Second album.
You spent a sort of inordinate amount of time
on
Lucy Dacus. If you want a long read about the contemporary state of making indie rock, Joe Coscarelli has you.
It's true.
Speak on it.
Lucy Dacus, I found on Bandcamp, I guess, a couple years ago. Her first album was called No Burden. Came out initially on Egg Hunt Records, which was a small label in Richmond, Virginia, where
balling
she's
like
from.
Balling like an athlete, but got No Burden.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it just caught me right away, and I didn't know anything about her or the album, but I just started listening to it a lot, and I had no idea who sang it or where this band came from. For some reason, I just didn't do any research on it, but I would just always put it on. And
how did you get to it on Bandcamp?
I don't, I really have no memory of discovering it, but, I'm sure somebody tweeted it or...
It's a big haystack. And that's
it is a big haystack, yeah. But it really stuck with me. And then when I finally looked her up, I think to write like a week ahead blurb for Arts and Leisure, like, we would just do a paragraph on who was coming to town. I figured out that she was like 20 years old, and I was a little bit blown away because it sounds like a record by someone who'd been making records for a long time.
Like a 24-year-old.
Yeah, like a 24-year-old who'd been making records since 18. I don't know, Then she was signed to Matador, basically. Mm-hmm. Soon after that album was released, it like got a fair amount of good attention, and she was signed to Matador, which is one of the biggest indie rock labels still. And
it's worth noting something that I think wasn't happening, and you guys can correct me if I'm not totally right about this, but I feel like there was a period in maybe the late 2000s, early 2010s, when those sort of heritage labels, Matador, Merge, etc., were not as aggressively pursuing like of the moment talent. They were sort of doubling down.
Hanging in there with the catalog.
Sort of like, so-and-so's sixth album.
Yes, and that's
kind of
and,
a vibe. Yeah.
And I, the less we speak of Matador's hip hop phase, the better.
What's your favorite album from that time?
I definitely remember. I definitely own a CD sampler of rappers on Matador.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know.
I don't have that.
Go cop that on Discogs if you don't have that.
But everybody had What's Up Matador, the two CD set. Mm,
there you go. But like that was a thing that like 7 or 8 years ago was like not as much of a thing. But now I feel like those sort of like, I guess at this point, their heritage labels have actually kind of fully come around.
Yeah. Beggars Group is like the sort of umbrella company for a handful of those labels. And basically Matador signed Lucy Dacus and re-released No Burden sort of later that year, 2015, I guess.
Should we listen to the big record off of that?
Yeah, let's listen to the song we heard initially, Night Shift, is the first song on the new album, Historian, and this is the first song on No Burden called I Don't Want to Be Funny Anymore. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about this song for a minute. Like, this is very acute songwriting.
Yeah. And for the first track on a debut album, it's just like,
it's pretty wild.
It's a real gut punch.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's about making music and about creating, which adds a sort of wisdom to her, adding to this sort of sense that she's beyond her years. And it's funny. It's sad.
It's smart.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also, she always has a great melody.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a real musician behind this wit.
Yeah. So I basically, you know, was in touch with Matador. They knew that I was a fan and they were sort of like, do you want to write about her? I was like, you know, this album's been out for a while. She sort of got her first wave of coverage. And then they offered me to come to the studio to go to Nashville, where she was going to be recording her second album. And so
you were there now from the based on the story.
Yeah.
They did the whole record in kind of a week or so.
Yeah.
And you were there for much.
I was there like 2 days. I think they had tracked a lot of it. You know, I wasn't there when they were laying down first takes, basically. Mm-hmm. By the time I got there, it was like it was coming along. I think it probably would have been weird to have a stranger there while you're really laying down the first sounds of your new album.
I don't know why you'd ever say that. All musicians, please allow us to come and watch you lay down your full your stakes.
Right. I don't know if you want to be there when they're getting the drum sound.
Right.
I mean, it's excruciating.
So I was there, you know, I was there for details more than...
And lead vocals.
And some vocals. Yeah, she was definitely recording some vocals. And I didn't really know what the story would become at that point, but I knew, you know, it would be interesting to sort of track this person as she's basically releasing her first big album that has an audience and has expectations. So, yeah, I spent a few days with her and her guitarist, Jacob, and the producer, Colin, who she made her first album with, which was actually a school project for the
guitar
player.
Not even for her.
No, she had dropped out of film school. She was hanging around in Richmond, I guess, and her friend at Oberlin, who plays guitar in her band, Jacob Blizzard, he needed to make a project over winter break. Colin, their friend, lives in Nashville. He's a producer. And they made a pretty amazing thing, and they got back together to do it again with Historian. So basically over the next year or so, I would meet up with her when she was in New York, you know, doing various music business appointments that you have to keep when you're sort of getting your career off the ground. we would just have lunch or check in that way. And so, you know, it ended up being a sort of interesting way to watch somebody's career be born. And I was mostly struck by, as in her songs, she's just an extremely thoughtful, wants to be very intentional in everything that she does. And she thinks through it all. And she's a great communicator because she's a writer. So she, you know, she really thought about what it meant to make music her career when it was something that she was never really striving for, but obviously had this well of talent and material to get out there.
One of the things that you talk about in the piece, and I'm curious to hear more about, is these days, especially in the last 2 years, but really in the last, I think, decade, the kind of rapid rate at which young people who put music on the internet are all of a sudden like, hey, you're a touring star now.
Right. You have a career.
Yeah. You're official. And that
you were messing around with your friends in the basement, and now all of a sudden you're a professional.
And you see this in everything from Lil Gnar to to Lucy Dacus.
Right. Or Julian Baker, who did the same thing. You know, right. School Project is the first album. Yeah. Nobody expects anybody to hear it. And then suddenly, like, you have audiences falling at your feet.
Yeah.
I wondered, as someone who not only writes songs about creativity, but also seems pretty self-aware, I wonder if you sensed from her any resistance or reluctance, basically being so private and so in a corner and then realizing everything is up for scrutiny.
I think she had those reservations, but was also very aware of the shot that she was being given, that, you know, most people who want to have those audiences,
right,
you know, they dream of it every night, like, they'll never have that chance. And she saw it as an
opportunity.
Yeah, she saw it as having gotten plucked, as Perella said, like, out of this weird haystack, and she really wanted to take advantage of that. I think the other thing was, she seems to be one of these people who creates no matter what. So I think she had bodies of work ready. Like, mm-hmm. you know, I think even if this second album wouldn't have been a hyped thing, it would have come out the same way. She had, you know, she had conceived of it basically before the first album was even done. You know, she's always writing in journals. She's always writing these songs. And, you know, when they came in to make the first album, I think, like, she had these songs sort of tucked away. It wasn't like she was here to make a school project and then just like magic these songs appeared.
Like,
she'd been working on them.
It was like she only had 8 songs.
Yeah. And even with the new, and even with this cycle, she's basically like, I already know what the third album is. Like, I already know what it's about. Her albums all both have sort of arcs to them. There are pieces that come back around. There's callbacks and sort of Easter eggs and melodies that reprise later. And, you know, she has a whole elaborate theory about how the track list works. Like, everything is very deliberate. So I think that when that chance was offered to her, she'd already been sort of doing the blueprints in her head.
Do you want to listen to something from later in the record?
Yeah, let's play Time Fighter is one of my favorites.
You gotta let me.
So that was Time Fighter. One thing that struck me about this record is it starts out with that very personal breakup song.
Right, super acidic breakup song.
But it's like, you know, two people having it out. But by the time you get to the end of the album, she's talking about time. She's talking about mortality. She's talking about creativity. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not as interior focused. Mm-hmm. It's larger issues. She also does these pretty, pardon the expression, epic arrangements.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. She's thought about how a song should crest and build mm-hmm. and take you away instrumentally, too. It's not just... let's deliver the words.
Yeah, I think she's very fixated on this idea of Lucy Dacus, not as her singer-songwriter project, but as a rock band, basically. And I think part of that is...
And there's not another producer, right? It's the same. Yeah. Everything is the same.
Yeah, everything's
it's just the idea is the same. Bigger.
Yeah, the idea of Historia in the new album is bigger. But I think, yeah, she was adamant that these aren't really breakup songs. You know, when you think female singer-songwriter, the default, the stereotype is this is going to be 10 songs about breaking up with a guy, and basically Night Shift is seemingly the only one.
Right, she's done. She's moving on. Yeah,
and then the album becomes about other sorts of loss, other sorts of grief, getting past those things.
Yeah, I was going to say the getting past it part was key. One thing that I was really struck by in her profile was how she said that, like, you know, there's sort of the cliche that something has to be hopeless or depressing.
Yeah.
And she was, like, trying to make a hopeful record.
Yeah, I think she, you know, something that does come through in her youth, like in a lot of ways, she doesn't seem as young as she is, but she has an optimism, I think, that can come, you know, with not having it beaten out of you yet, you know.
What would you ever be talking about? I have no idea. I will say I struggled a little bit with the density of this record, mm-hmm. and this is something where I probably preferred the first record. I think those arrangements, while impressive and on a technical level and occasionally on an emotional level, sometimes I felt disconnected from the kind of spirituality of the lyric. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It took me away, and I found myself kind of a ping-ponging back and forth between engaging with the arrangement and engaging with the ideas. And sometimes I felt like the arrangement became the dominant narrative driver, and that's not that that's bad inherently, but I'm sort of very taken with her as a songwriter from a structural and a detail level perspective, and I started to kind of get bummed anytime I got yanked out of that.
Yeah, I think one of the pluses for me, having spent a year with this album now, you mm-hmm. know, in various forms, from
flex.
What I mean, from hearing it in the studio,
Joe got WAV files. You can't demos. Even imagine.
They used to call that humble bragging, Joe. Yes.
Ain't nothing humble about it.
No, but it's an album that's meant to be played front to back. You know, there's not a single mm-hmm. on this one, even in the way that there was on mm-hmm. the last one. You know, it rewards investment and engagement, and once you sort of learn those ins and outs.
Listener?
No, I'm just saying.
Just superficial.
You've heard it fewer times than me.
That's fair.
The other thing we were talking about with regards to Lucy was her voice. Mm-hmm. JP, maybe you can describe it, since that's why we pay you the big bucks.
Yes. True story.
She must have had some kind of musical education. Film studies, whatever. But I mean, she must have sung somewhere. She must have grown up singing, because she's got a lot of breath control. Yeah. She never choked. She never stumbled. There's always a long line in her song.
Right.
I began to get lost in it a little bit. And coming off of the first record, where I felt like that didn't happen a mm-hmm. lot, I thought the choices, especially for what best suits her voice and what best suits her approach, it didn't feel kind of as tight.
You want to go A&R the next record, John?
Karen, what is podcast if not informal A&R?
I know, I was going to say, everyone? If not informal job applications.
please don't hire me.
Yeah.
don't ever hire me.
Maybe. Send it to me after it's done.
Yeah, I'm good with that.
She was too legato for you, John.
Some legato ass singing.
Yeah.
True story.
So maybe should we go out with another sad one, or one of the more upbeat ones?
No, let's go upbeat.
Okay. Let's listen to The Shell, which is the third song on the album, and it's the one that's, I think, most obviously about what it means to create and what it means to create for a living.
I'm a ghost walking in a boring dream. You are there talking and I'm not listening. Now I see it clearly. you've got nothing to say. Put down the pen, don't let it force your hand.
As we're transitioning into some of the other folks we're talking about, I want to spend a few minutes, not too long, because the record is not that current, but on Julian Baker. And the reason I want to do that is because Julian Baker's on a very similar arc to Lucy Dacus. And Joe, a thing that you talk about in your piece, is that they've developed something of a rapport.
Yeah, and I remember them. I remember Lucy mentioning it, you know, last March when she was recording this album, because I think Julian, who also got signed to Matador after her first sort of Bandcamp-y release. Had just, I think, just finished making what became her second album, which came out at the beginning of this year, end of last year.
I think it was the end of last year.
Which we've talked about, I think, maybe a few times in passing on the podcast.
Never spent a lot of
time. But I think they had recently gone on a road trip together, and you know, Julian had played Lucy her new songs, which really had inspired her to go into the studio and lay down her new songs, her own new songs, and I think, you know, they both come from the South. They're really in charge of their musical projects, even though they have collaborators, and they just both have made really strong
singer-songwriter albums. Well, also, Julian Baker's really intentional, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's thinking about the theological implications of each line.
Yes.
It's not an automatic right.
Right.
Yeah, so to that point, let's listen to something from this last Julian Baker record. Let's listen to Televangelist.
My heart is gonna eat itself. I don't need anybody's help. It's just me.
JP, when you profiled Julian Baker ahead of this album, you used Lucy as a secondary quote.
Well, actually, when I finished the interview with Julian Baker, she was meeting Lucy for lunch.
Ah, there you go.
It was
I'm jealous of the scene.
Yeah, seriously, like, yo, like what Panera bread is this all popping off with?
So then these were independently run. Probably vegan cafe.
All right.
Were you in Virginia for that?
Nashville.
Nashville. Ah, yes.
But there's a line on the Lucy album, a song called, I think, Body to Flame, another happy immolation song. but the line is one that they share, and I think a lot of female songwriters share, which is, believe me, I'm speaking plainly and painfully, which is kind of the
mission statement.
Yeah. Exactly.
But then I stole your idea and used Julian as a secondary quote in my piece. We had a nice email exchange about how they sort of go to each other for, you know, for guidance during this strange time in their lives and careers.
Yeah, and it's also like, this is like, we're not, unlike, say, the package we put together last year, which is maybe a little bit more pegged to whether it's specific locales or even just a specific moment in time, I think the people we're talking about today aren't necessarily, I wouldn't label a scene of any kind, but there are all these consonances, there are all these overlaps, and some of them are public and some of them are behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And I was very struck that these two singer-songwriters, both moving in a very similar direction in parallel fashion, actually are
conversant,
woven together.
Yeah, they're contemporaries in like a really heartening way. You know, they're engaged with one another's work and motivated by one another. And they're generationally the same, and they like to think about a lot of the same big questions.
Plus, there's no instruction manual for this. I mean, you know, you're a young person suddenly cast out of making something privately for yourself that you have to make to making something that you know is going to face the world. And it's not a situation a lot of people are in. So it's good they can talk to each other.
Yeah, as far as introducing themselves to a larger audience, there was a performance that Julian Baker did of her, of the title track of this new album, Turn Out the Lights, this year, earlier this year, I believe, on Stephen Colbert, that really just blew me away. Just pretty much her alone on a dark stage. And by the time she gets to belting, it felt like an arrival.
To the point of sort of informal networks that we were just talking about a second ago, it reminds me a lot of when we were doing the bunk package last year, talking to Lindsay from Snail Mail and about her relationship with the Crutchfields. And there is a lot of this stuff happening. And again, it's not necessarily all things you see. You don't necessarily see it in the music. You don't necessarily see it in collaborations. But these networks are helping and sustaining people. Thinking about that bunk package, let's talk about Soccer Mommy, who has a new record out this week. JP, you wrote about it, but let's listen to one of the great songs of 2018 so far as I'm concerned, which is Your Dog.
Oh yeah.
We're gonna edit out that noise.
No, we're keeping that noise, and we're keeping this part of the conversation about that noise. Oh,
fire
Lord.
Reaction.
Oh Lord.
An answer song to
it,
Pop.
I mean, it is.
There is a classic Stooges song, Now I Want to Be Your Dog. Yes. She takes the metaphor of being someone's pet and ornament to its natural limit in this song and throws it back in the person's face.
It is scathing.
I mean, the attitude on this album is just
and that's the big
on
change.
11 in a great way.
That's yes. The big change on this album.
So this album's called Clean. And it is also, in the same way that the Lucy Dacus record is the sort of upstreamed 2.0 Lucy Dacus, this album is the sort of upstream 2.0. It is on Fat Possum, not Matador Emerge, but same principle. It is bigger, it is thicker, but it is also much harsher. The attitude is on, wow, it's OD.
So last year she put out an album called Collection that was mainly re-recordings of her Bandcamp material, yeah, right? And this is sort of her proper debut.
And I really, really liked a lot of the old stuff too. But this is like getting punched in the face like with an ice pack.
2018, everyone's bringing the fire.
Seriously.
Well, I mean, her previous stuff, a lot of it was about, you know, falling in love and being sort of sad and lonely and lost and lovelorn.
Right.
And she snapped back a little on Collection with Outworn, mm-hmm, which was one of the two newer songs on it. So she was clearly not going to be the sad sack forever.
Well, she moved to New York. She got hardened. She came to NYU from Nashville, where she's from, right? Sophie Allison is the singer-songwriter. Mm-hmm. She's, what, 20 also?
I think she's 20.
Yeah. 20 years old. And yeah, I feel like, you know, a year at NYU will do that to you.
Joe speaks from experience.
Tell us about your freshman year at NYU.
Well, you know the
coming
the,
from Florida,
the closing
Florida.
Scene of Lady Bird when she finally gets to college in New York and she gets super drunk at a party and some guy looks at her CD case and tells her it sucks because she only has greatest hits.
Yes.
And she
Wait,
says,
"Were you that guy?"
I think I was the girl. I definitely have my CD, you know, my CD booklet.
It's amazing.
But you know, you do meet men like that when you move to New York City.
Fair point. And then she left.
And then she left.
So
good for her.
Is that what happens in the next part of Lady Bird?
She goes back to Sacramento.
She goes back and makes a fire album
for Bandcamp.
Yeah, for put on Band.
I'm gonna cry.
That's Lady Bird. No, Lady Bird 2. Bandcamp Boogaloo.
But the thing about this Soccer Mommy album is that it should be the soundtrack to every female coming of age movie, like from Lady Bird to like Edge of 17, like put this in Can't Hardly Wait, like remaster.
If this isn't
like
your sync music, you're not about that life.
Yeah, anything that takes place like at a high school house party or whatever, like needs a Soccer Mommy
or freshman
song.
Year.
Yeah, or freshman year. Yeah.
Can we just listen to more? I just want to listen to more Soccer Mommy. Let's listen to Blossom, Wasting All My Time.
Wasting all my time, wondering if you really loved me. I was wasting all my time, thinking about the way you treat me. Wasting all my time on someone who didn't know me. I was wasting all my time on someone who couldn't love me. And I knew when I met you, I'm not the one you wanna be with. 'Cause I can't see someone who really wants me.
I want to drop a funk flex bomb on these records. That's how intensely I feel for this record.
So the thing is, though, this is a much more also musical record than the last. Because I mean, she moved out of bedroom pop and sort of strumming through the song. Mm-hmm. This has a producer. It has verses and choruses that are very differently textured. It has lots of weird guitar effects going on. It's still very indie rock. It's still very not quite in tune, but but
that's part of its charm.
Oh, yeah,
that is its charm.
Part of its charm. Yeah,
but it's got a lot more thought.
That's what I said about Fergie too. Got to fight people on the internet about it.
But she did keep it lo-fi. I think that that's a like whereas the Lucy Dacus album
got horn sections
and the Phoebe Bridgers album,
Lucy
which
Dacus
I think
the Decemberists,
yeah,
track.
Which we're going to talk about. Like those got more ornamental. They're sort of more slick. But this one stayed pretty dirty, right? I feel like it's a little grittier, both in subject matter and in production.
I feel like the musical evolution on this record is very much in service of the lyrics.
Yeah.
And again, sort of in a way that's not what happened with the Lucy Dacus record, where they kind of, I think, grew maybe slightly apart. This feels like, I mean, and I don't know, we didn't have anyone embedded in the studio on the Soccer Mommy record like we did with Lucy Dacus.
We should have.
We should have. But I feel
only
like
one
this,
of
is,
me.
This came in. That's, damn, Joe. There's only one of me, too. There is, it does feel like it came in hot, and then the guitars to match. The guitars came in.
And you don't think she's too legato for you?
No. Very much. Brah, brah, brah.
One of the other things that stuck out to me in listening to this album over the last few weeks is the songs about sort of femininity and other women and girls. Like, there's a lot of, it's again, like the Lucy album, it's not all heartbreak. Like, there's some, right. mm-hmm. there's some stuff about basically looking at your peers and deciding how you measure up.
Mm-hmm.
There's one called Cool.
Which is not as tough as the girl she's looking at.
Right. And then there's Last Girl as well, which I think you compared it in your review to a 60s girl group song in its subject matter.
Yeah. Should we listen to a little Last Girl?
Yeah.
Sure.
So Soccer Mommy was in town recently playing a couple shows for Phoebe Bridgers, who I saw this show at the Music Hall of Williamsburg. JP was also there. And to be honest, like when I thought about the kind of sonic choices of the people who we were going to be talking about today, Soccer Mommy was a little bit of the outlier. And I was inclined to include her both because I thought the record was great, but also because of this tour pairing. Phoebe Bridgers had a very, very good album that came out last year.
Stranger in the Alps.
Thank you. Thank you, Joe.
Got it.
Stranger in the Alps. And I thought this was an unusual, maybe a slightly unusual pairing on a tour, but some simpatico through lines.
I think fans are probably a big overlap in fans, right? Even if not in the exact sound.
Certainly
of the
seemed
two
like
albums.
In the room. Yeah. I mean, you know, like people didn't leave right. after Soccer Mommy.
Right.
So Phoebe Bridgers, I feel like, has a lot in common with some of the other folks that we've been talking about. In the past on podcasts, we've talked about Funeral, which is, I think, one of the highlights of that album. And I was very struck, I think, and I know I said this to at least one of you after the show, I was maybe a little caught off guard by the LA-ness of Phoebe Bridgers.
But how could you be with that album?
That's what I was saying. The lyrics are all LA.
I know. And that's like the
for a very specific
line.
Kind, very specific parts of LA.
Because, I mean, she's.
But her arrangements are really convincing in a slightly different direction.
Except that reverb guitar is total Lana Del Rey.
Yes. No, there's Laurel Canyon, all that stuff. Yes. There was just something, maybe the emotional acuity is just not something I typically associate with Los
Ooh,
Angeles.
Shots.
Whoa. I'm just saying.
We all agree
this
here.
Like the,
I think we all agree.
The New York Times story,
table.
Like throwing bars
in LA. I'm just saying, unless you are a close personal friend of mine, if you live in LA, I don't know. I can't
You
speak
mean all
it.
Of your close personal friends?
Say,
yes, unfortunately.
All of our friends have moved to LA.
But like accepting those people.
Yes.
I can't vouch for not one thing that happens in Los Angeles. So maybe I was a little thrown.
Did Phoebe Bridgers grow up in Los Angeles? I don't know her biography.
I think she did. I think she went to, at minimum, I think she went to high school in Los Angeles. But I'm almost certain she is a child of Los
Angeles. Well, should we listen to the first song on the album, which has a lot of LA locales in it?
While we get our statistician on this?
Yes, let's do that.
Smoke Signals.
I went with you up to the place you grew up in. We spent a week in the cold, just long enough to walden it with you. Any longer it would have got old. Singing Ace of Spades when Lemmy died, but nothing's changed. LA's alright. I'm sleeping in my bed again and getting in my head and then walk around.
So, yes.
Talk about her LA-ness.
You mean in person?
Yeah, on stage.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about why I kind of came, how I arrived at it. And I think I arrived at Phoebe Bridgers initially through the songs that felt, I don't want to say rootsy, but the arrangements had an earnestness. And even if the lyrics were, like I said, emotionally acute or talking about $1,500 hypnotherapists.
That's not LA.
I don't know. My hypnotherapist doesn't cost that much. but I think I believed the arrangements. And not to say that those arrangements were not in play at that show. They were. But there was something so easeful about the whole thing. It was so polished. It was a polished version of unpolished emotions, and I was very caught up. When I say it's L.A., I don't mean it's like L.A. specific with the references. I mean in presentation.
No, it is that also.
It is
yes.
that. But I mean in the presentation and in the attitude, it was so confident. And it's funny because like when I first arrived at this music, I felt it was meek is not the right word, but interior. And there was nothing interior about that show.
I mean,
except
it's,
the song,
right? Except the actual right. song.
I think
the presentation.
Yeah, I think one of the things you're describing is that, like, out of anyone we've talked about so far today, like, she has the highest ceiling. I think commercially, I'll put it this way: the time I realized that Phoebe Bridgers could be as big as she wanted to, basically, was at the Standard in Miami over the holidays.
Okay.
And her song came on.
Joe, you're just flexing all of
it.
I'm from Florida. I'm sorry.
We're sorry.
From the Standard? From the Standard?
You know, sometimes you want to swim in a nice pool.
Oh my God.
But they were blasting Motion Sickness,
yeah.
which is, you know, one of the singles from this album. And I hadn't heard it in quite that context before. yeah. And I was like, oh, I get this mm-hmm. now.
Should yeah. we listen to
which
Motion?
Which, no shade, you know.
No shade.
Just
yeah, like all these things that all these things that we are shading are all things we also like. So it's like, don't take it that way.
It says more about you than Phoebe Bridgers, really.
what doesn't?
Yeah.
Let's listen to a little Motion Sickness, future banger hit. So I listened to this record again today, and in addition to the sheer LA-ness of the record, again, I was extremely taken with her song structure. I think out of everybody who we're talking about today, including Lucy Degas, who's extremely structured, her structural integrity is very high, Phoebe Bridgers writes the most structurally sound songs. And I think that's to your point, Joe, that she has a very high ceiling, which is I don't think there's a lot of anxiety on this record about scene or genre or
am I lo-fi enough?
Yeah, that I think there's no anxiety. And I think seeing her live made something that I had not been able to verbalize previously fully clear.
And I think what she's able to do to sort of counterbalance that slickness or whatever, is just the specificity of the songs and the lyrics.
Yeah.
There's something, like, if you're listening to it in passing, it can sound very, you know, could have been maybe from the 90s. But if you listen to, like, the references, they're very, not only hyper-local, but they're very, you know, there's shower beer, mm-hmm. there's, like, you know, the song about playing Would You Rather, just these little sort of human moments. And the imagery is just very specific to, I think, what it's like to be a relatively young person.
A young woman specifically
in this era. You know, that she doesn't shy away from pop culture references or geographic references or these things that make it feel very intimate.
Well, the other thing about that made me feel like it's an LA record is she's always measuring herself against pop culture, against movie stars, against images and songs, song titles. She has a line about how soon is now.
Mm-hmm.
It's growing up in an entertainment factory. Entertainment is your yardstick. Mm-hmm. And that feels very LA to me.
There is something about all of these albums that scan as a little bit 90s to me. I think there's parallels for each of these women, maybe, in the 90s. So, Karen, as a resident expert, which...
I feel like this is why you invited me here today.
If you had to pair...
In the Karen Gans Memorial Chair.
Oh, wow, this is fun.
Lucy Dacus, Soccer Mommy, and Phoebe Bridgers with their 90s counterparts.
Oh, that's rough.
Where would you go?
Well, JP and I think agreed that Soccer Mommy is analogous to Liz Phair.
Right.
Super Liz Phair.
Yeah.
And when we had our roundtable punk girls package.
Best day of our lives.
Yeah. One of the things that's on the cutting room floor is asking these young women to sing a little bit into a camera of songs that inspired them.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh.
And I mean, we should pull it up, actually, when we publish this.
Yeah.
But when I asked Sophie from Soccer Mommy, she sang Pedro, sorry, Run by Liz Phair.
Yes.
And we all giggle.
It was amazing. And also it rang very true.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, now I got to think about who Lucy and Phoebe are. This is like a homework assignment. You can email us at podcast@nytimes.com.
Yeah. Karen will tweet the best answer.
Yes, I will.
But basically, in short, as JP has said off mic, like, we're not saying that these, you know, this moment of female singers and songwriters is in any way new.
No, it's just been particularly rich the past two years, which is a great revival.
But I also think there's no barrier now. I mean, if you were going to be Joni Mitchell, you had to get through the hurdles of the music business. Now you just put it on Bandcamp. So you have a lot wider and probably a lot more amateurish at one end spectrum of possibilities. And occasionally they get through.
Well, that's a good segue because...
Love a good segue.
I was going to say, if Kim Deal had Bandcamp, she probably would have put out like 5,000 albums a year.
Yeah. Sure.
You know,
sure
I mean, story. This is a person who is completely obsessed with sound and making sounds and music and being, you know, in the studio 24 hours a day. And conveniently, the Breeders have a new
Breeders
album.
Breeders back.
Let's listen to Nervous Mary, which is the first song on the new Breeders record called All Nerve.
Heartbeat, hustle and pound sheet.
So we recently ran a profile of the Breeders.
We did.
And Melina Ryzik, who wrote it, couldn't be here today, but Karen Gans, who edited it and also embodied it.
Yes.
For many years.
Yes, like for literally two decades. As good as the real thing. I can have Kim Deal, I can have Kelly Deal, or I can have Karen Gans. I choose Karen Gans.
I appreciate that.
So explain to us a little bit about the backstory about why this is happening now, because it's the key lineup. It's not that there has never been a Breeders record.
Yes,
in 20 years.
There have been Breeders records. Yes. There was after the record that everyone probably knows best, which was 1993. 3, Last Splash. Mm-hmm. There was one before that called Pod. There were two after that called Title TK, which I really love. Love a journalism reference.
Sure.
And Mountain Battles, which came out in 2008. There have been some singles and stuff between then. What's important right now is that the lineup that made All Nerve is the lineup that made Last Splash. You will recognize the song Cannonball. We don't need to play it. You know it. I'm not going to sing it.
Did Cannonball ever make it to Guitar Hero?
I don't think
That's a good question.
I feel like
that would be a good,
That would,
should be on in the expansion pack. If
it's possible. That's a good question. But anyway, the lineup is back. Jim McPherson, the drummer, Josephine Wiggs, the bassist, Kim and Kelly Deal, in effect. And Melina Story.
Ohio.
Dayton, Ohio is where this all takes place. And Melina really got at something special about the Deals, which I've been fascinated with for a long time, which is like the Breeders are the Breeders because they are just so particularly the Breeders. They are always so quintessentially themselves. They are not putting on airs. They didn't become fancy when they had, you know, Cannonball, when they had some hits. They toured with Nirvana. They are really just themselves. And part of their dynamic is like they're twins, but they fight and resolve and fight and resolve in such a specific way that Josephine Wiggs killed me when she compared them to Lady Bird and her mom in the scene in the movie.
Second Lady Bird reference. Yeah.
The scene in the movie where they're in, they show this all the time on promo, so you might be familiar, where they're in the thrift store shopping for a dress for the prom or whatever she's going to, and they're fighting like, you know, cats and dogs, and all of a sudden they pull out the dress. It's like, oh, and they get along again. Like, that is Kim and Kelly Deal. And you can sort of hear that tension and release in the music. I mean, the album does sound a more like, quote-unquote, classic Breeders. Mountain Battles was kind of spacey and jammy and out there, and this is not really that. But key things that Melina gets at in the interview are part of what makes this album different is the fact that they actually do, they learned how to resolve these fights. They're in their 50s now, and they've matured. And sobriety, which is something new for this band, that they made this album out of sobriety. And Steve Albini, who worked on it a little bit, not going to call him a producer, was very careful to call him an engineer or recorded it. And yeah, I've learned that.
We do not want the angry emails from
I learned
Mr.
that
Albini.
In 2000 when I started this. Yeah.
Steve Albini, the accountant.
Yes. Well, not a producer.
The data systems manager.
But he had a couple of quotes that he emailed Melina where he was like, you know, it was a real shame to see Kim descend into the depths of addiction, sort of at the height of her fame because she's so talented. But he thinks that she's making some of her most vital music now in maturity.
That just lets me know that there is a lot of great stuff to come
there
from
is.
Everyone that we have been speaking about for the entire duration of this podcast.
Yeah, don't do drugs.
Don't
do,
please.
Well, another great detail about that was Josephine said that Kim and Kelly would vanish before shows and they'd vanish after shows, you know, and that during Lollapalooza, which was the Lollapalooza right before that this lineup broke up, she had so much downtime from not interacting with Kim and Kelly that she learned how to six-pin juggle.
Wow.
That's that some downtime.
That was the Duolingo.
It's not a metaphor.
That was the Duolingo of 94.
Yeah. No, she actually, with Carrie Bradley, who plays violin on Driving on 9, the two of them juggled. Can I add one thing I forgot?
Yeah.
Belly has a new album coming out, guys.
Do you think that it's directly inspired by the Breeders' comeback?
Or is it competitive?
No, I don't think it's competitive, but I think they've been working on it. Obviously, you guys know I see these bands, so I went to see Belly, right. And they implied that they were going to be working on a new record.
Karen Gaines, not everybody is privileged enough to see Karen Gaines' IG stories, but for those of us who are privileged enough to see Karen Gaines' IG stories, it's a lot of shows.
It's a lot of shows.
It's a lot of shows of this nature.
I saw Bananarama this weekend, guys.
Yeah. I saw that.
Can only be yourself. The best version of yourself.
Quintessentially on brand. But anyway, excited about this Belly record. Just want to throw that in there. Belly has a relationship to the Breeders via Tanya Donnelly in the initial lineup of the Breeders, played on, you know, Pod.
And left.
But also, you know, the connection was through the Pixies, which, of course, Kim Deal originally was in, toured with Throwing Muses. And she and Tanya decided to do a side project because they were kind of bored.
Karen Gann's a true detective of early 90s indie rock.
Well, don't forget, I wrote a book about this.
We thank you. That's a true story.
By Karen's
book. Plug your book.
It was the Fool of the World, the oral history of a band called Pixies.
Go cop that.
2006. It's classic.
Go cop that. Karen Gann's the only person at this table who's written a book. What have y'all done with your life?
Thanks, John. True.
So now, let us go out on a Breeder song. What song should we go out on?
Do you want to go classic Breeders or are we going to go new
album?
No,
let's go new.
We'll go out with Wait in the Car, which was the first single that they brought this album back with, which sounds pretty classic Breeders and includes some meowing as lyrics.
Wait in the Car.
Wait in the Car.
Urgh.
I hope you enjoyed my monologue on the Breeders.
Of course. Yeah. That's our monologue on the Breeders. Thank you to my guests, Joe Coscarelli, Karen Gans, John Perellis. Some shout outs this week. Shout out to Soft Swerve. Shout out to JJ Johnson, Chef in the Kitchen. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. You should email us. Email us your 90s comparisons.
Yeah, for these women.
For these and everybody else. Everybody
any band that exists today.
I'd like to hear it for rappers, too. Actually, I'd love to hear 90s rap comparisons.
That's fun, yeah.
Popcast at nytimes.com. We will gather them and report back on a later show. You can subscribe to the podcast, which, if you're sensible, you already do. And if you are having some emotional challenges, we invite you to put them aside and subscribe right now. Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, anywhere you get your audio content. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We're back next week.